At Creekside, we are currently learning about a place called heaven, and last week I spent 30 or 40 minutes talking about how messed up the world is, and so it's kind of an awkward fit, and I won't do that again today, but I do want to remind you of what we talked about, and I don't think last week I was talking anybody into anything that they already didn't believe. I just said that the world is a messed up place, and I think each of us know that by the different things that go on in our lives. I think we know that because of the broken families that we come from. I think that we know that because of the broken relationships that we have. I think that we know that because of our loved one who has an illness, died of an illness, the illness that we have. I think that we know that because so many things that we wish we didn't do, we keep doing, and so many things we wish that we did do, we just can't seem to do. I think that we know that because we look around and we see natural disasters in the world, and we see problems, we see a bad economy, and we see things that we know just shouldn't be in existence, and we look around and we go, this world is just a messed up place. And I think that each of us, somewhere inside of us, know that the world we live in is not the way the world should be. I think each of us want to believe the words of the song. I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and for you. And I think to myself, yeah, that's what you think, right? I didn't know these lyrics until I looked them up this week, so I'll keep going just to enlighten you. I see skies of blue, clouds of white, bright blessed days, dark sacred nights. The colors of rainbow so pretty in the sky are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. And I think to myself, yeah. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, but here's the truth. We know that trees die. I have a dead tree in my backyard, right? And we know that the skies are not blue nearly as often as they should be. We especially know that in our state, right? And we know that when people walk by us, usually they don't say hi or how you doing, and very rarely do they mean I love you. And we really know, we all know this, that that baby that he mentions is probably going to have lots of hurts and pain and problems that that baby wishes that he won't have in his life. And so we know inside of us, and maybe we've never just said it out loud like this, but we know that the world is fallen. It's filled up with the curse, and I had this globe last week, and once you write murder, rape, and sin on a globe, you can't donate it back to Goodwill. And so I brought it back this week. We're not, if you want it for your kid or somebody you know, then you're willing to take it home with you. It's a great little geography game, actually, and it's cool, but kids gonna be like, where's murder? So that's bad. But we talked about how the world is cursed, right? And it has all of these problems. And I said last week, and it's worth repeating, that each of us, I think, somewhere inside of us asks the question, why is the world this way? Why is it that I see all these things that shouldn't be here, and I have all these problems that I shouldn't have, and there's all these difficulties that just shouldn't be a part of my life? And why is that? And maybe it's way down in the subconscious, because it seems like sometime at about 8 years old, you know, somebody gives us a short answer to why did grandma die? And you get the short answer, and by the time you're 20 years old, you've just learned that nobody's going to give you a real answer. But the Bible gives a real answer. And I know that not everybody that will listen to this sermon, maybe here online, will agree with what the Bible says, but everybody wants an answer. And I said last week that some people use science as the answer, and I read this article that talked about how biology is to give reason for rape, and I think that's a horrible answer. And I talked last week about karma, and remember the girl, if you were here, that saw a girl get hit, and then later she got hit in the day, and that was her explanation for why the world was messed up, because what goes around comes around. And I think that's a pretty terrible explanation too, and it just doesn't add up when I look around, because lots of jerks have better lives than me, and so it just doesn't make sense. And here's the Bible's explanation, and if you agree with it or not, I think you at least need to say, wow, that's a viable explanation, and it is at least as good as any of those explanations that are out there today. And so here's what the Bible says. The Bible says that God created the world, and it was absolutely perfect, and it was good, and he looks down and says, that's good. Then he created man and woman to inhabit the earth, and he looked down and he said, wow, they are good. I did a really good thing. But then, Adam and Eve were their names, they decided to be disobedient to God, something that in Christianity we call sin. They ate from a tree that God put in the middle of this garden so that they had the ability to disobey him. And they eat from it, and immediately we start seeing these consequences come into the world through their sin. We see immediately that there's bad feeling. Shame is the feeling that they feel. And we see immediately that the idea of pain is just comes. I mean, they hadn't even thought about pain and what it would mean to be hurt, but all of a sudden, now that's a part of their language. And we see immediately that all of a sudden the land is cursed and no longer is food everywhere, and we just have an overabundance of everything, but immediately it became more difficult, and the world now has people starving because of sin coming into the world. And we see immediately that there is broken relationships, and relationships between people are not everything that they're supposed to be. And what happens is that people keep sinning and sinning and sinning, and so the world is just filled up with this curse. So then I paused and I said, wow, this is the most depressing sermon ever, right? And I'll do that again, but it's shorter this time. At least you didn't hear that for 30 minutes today, right? And I said, but the Bible gives us this great picture of hope. The Bible says that Jesus comes from God, and Jesus was not under the curse because he was fully God and fully man. And he comes and he lives, and because he's not under the curse, he's able to take the curse upon himself when he dies on a cross to save people from the curse and the sin and the death that come along with the curse. And so I told you last week that you have the ability now to come out from under the curse because Jesus took the curse for you. And if you will say, Jesus, I believe that I am a sinner and I need a Savior and I'm looking at you and I think you're that guy, and you will believe that, and you will say, Jesus, I accept that and I give you my life, I'm going to live for you, then God is going to give you the freedom from the curse that you desire. You can come out from underneath that curse. And that's a great thing for us to see. And when we looked last week, we turned our attention to Revelation 21, 1 through 8, and we just kind of briefly got there last week. I want to read it to you again. Revelation 21, 1 through 8. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. He was seated on the throne, said, I am making everything new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all of this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. But the cowardly and the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters, and all liars, they will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. And so here's kind of the picture. And remember, I brought the guys last week. I didn't bring them back. It just kind of made people laugh. It was supposed to be dramatic. And so we had these guys last. I brought little mini people. And they're on the earth. And here's the picture that the Bible paints. It says that when you become a Christian, you come out from under the curse. You are no longer under the slavery of sin. You can avoid the things that you want to avoid. You can do the things that you want to do. And it says that you now can replace all those ill feelings that you wish you didn't have, of depression and anxiety and worry and fear and anger, with all of the good stuff that you wish you did have, like joy and peace and happiness and mercy and the feeling of grace. And so we saw that, but here is the problem that the Bible tells us. Even if you come out from the curse, you become a Christian, you still live on a cursed-filled world. You live here, and so the curse continues to affect you, and you still have struggles. Life is better as a Christian, I promise you that, but it is still not everything that you want it to be. And so this Revelation 21, 1 through 8 passage, as we talked about last week, simply said When God comes back, when Jesus comes back, he is going to erase the curse from the world. He's going to take away everything that's bad about it. And if you are a Christian, you get to live in a perfect world forevermore. And so when we see Jesus coming back, if we are Christians, then we are looking forward to a time when everything that we struggle with on this planet just disappears. We're living under the curse, and we fight against it, and we struggle against it in every day of our lives. Whether we know it or not, every day of our lives, we are fighting against the curse. I mean, we're fighting to not die, right? I mean, we go out and exercise, and we try to eat good, and we're trying to avoid it, right? And we're trying not to sin, and we're trying not to do things that we know we shouldn't do, and we're struggling to not be sad about the stuff in the earth, and we turn off the TV and shut the newspaper, and we're like, man, I just don't like it. I don't want this curse, and we constantly live with this friction, whether Christian or not, between not wanting this world to be so messed up anymore, but knowing that it is, and that we live here. And Jesus says, when I come back, if you are a Christian, if you've given me your life, then all of that stuff will be erased. So last week we learned that heaven is at least as good as this earth without the curse. So I want to illustrate this for you. This is a stolen illustration. I've seen it a couple times. But here's what I need you to do. I need you to stand up again. Man, you're getting your exercise in today. And what we're going to do is I want you to clench your fists as hard as you can in your whole body. And I want the men to flex their pecs like they're looking in the mirror, right? And I want you to hold it and flex and clench your face just as hard as you can, okay? And I want you to hold that while I talk for a little bit, okay? And just hold it and hold it. And so this, I think, demonstrates the feeling of the curse. We're constantly just fighting against it, and it's a struggle. And maybe some days it's a little better and we're a little more relaxed. But even in our most relaxed moments, we're like this. And I tell you this about myself. Every night when I lay down, before I go to sleep, not just in a metaphorical sense, but in a literal sense, I have to tell my face to let it go because I just hold things in my face. And so we're like this, and I want you to hold as hard as you can. Give it about 20 more seconds, right? And this is the world we live in, just constantly fighting with ourselves and with the world and with the curse and with the sin nature that still fights against us and with people. And then on three, we're going to let it go, and we're going to throw our hands up in the air, right? And it's going to feel so good. Ready? On three. One, two, three. And the picture the Bible paints is that feeling right there. You can sit back down if you want to, or you can stand. The picture the Bible paints is that we are fighting against ourselves and our world and everybody else that's a wretched sinner on our planet, which is everybody, and we're constantly fighting against it. But when we get to heaven, if we have given our lives to Jesus, then it all goes away. My abs are a little sore now. I ran a long ways the other day. So that's the picture that the Bible gets us. And so you and I, if we've given our lives to Christ, look forward to that. But here's the cool part. And this is where I want to focus today. The Bible doesn't just tell us what will disappear when we get to heaven, when Christ returns to this earth and sets up the new heaven and the earth. He doesn't just say, hey, all the pain and the suffering and the sorrow goes away. Instead, he tells us that it's going to be glorious and magnificent beyond anything that we can see. And so if you'll continue with me, Revelation 21, I'll start in verse 9, I'll read through 26 to begin. It says this, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and said to me, come, I will show you the bride. And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of every precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and with 12 angels at the gates. On the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, 3 on the north, 3 on the south, and 3 on the west. The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. The angel who talked with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city, its gates and its walls. The city was laid out like a square as long as it was wide. He measured the city with a rod and found it to be 12,000 stadia in length, and as wide and high as it was long. The angel measured the wall using human measurements, and it was 144 cubits thick. The wall was made of jasper and the city of pure gold, as pure as glass. The foundations of the city wall were decorated with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth ruby, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth turquoise, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls, each gate made of a single pearl. The great street of the city was gold, as pure as transparent glass. I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. On no day will its gates be shut, for there will be no night there. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. And I'll stop there for now. My brother-in-law, Matt, right here in the front row, loves to tell an illustration, and some of you have heard it, but I'll tell it again. And I'm going to tell it from the first person. This is definitely not true of me. If you know me, it's very untrue. But I'll tell it from the first person because the effect is better. When I was a kid, I loved dogs. I got every book at the library that they would check out to me. And I had posters in my wall of German Shepherds and Dobermans and Rottweilers. My dog, and I would have them on my wall, and I just talked about him all the time, and I would go visit my friend's house just to play with his dog. I didn't even want to see him, and I would just do everything I could to learn about dogs because I loved them so much. And one day for my 8th birthday, my parents said to me, "We're going to buy you a dog," and so I was so excited, and we went down. And we went to the pet store, and we got to pick out the dog, and I picked out a dog. He was half Doberman, quarter German Shepherd, and a quarter Rottweiler. And we brought him home, and we got him to the house, and I was so excited, and his tail was wagging, and he was licking me. And we euthanized him, and I got him up on the table, and I cut him open, and I folded back his stomach, and I started to examine his intestines. And it was amazing to see, like, where his heart was and how his lungs were in a different place. Oh, that's weird. Yeah, that's not a true story, but it illustrates what oftentimes happens with the Bible. A lot of times when we approach a biblical passage, and I am as at fault as anybody with my seminary education, we tear it apart so much that sometimes we lose the beauty and the magnificence of what the passage is trying to say. In the book of Revelation, it is worse than any other book in the entire Bible. People approach the book of Revelation and they sit around and they want to argue and debate and figure out what all the details mean. And what happens is that a book that is stunningly brilliant, the book of Revelation, in the language that it uses, oftentimes loses its power and its effect because people get caught up in the details. This morning, in our passage, it would be easy to do that, but here's the thing. If we get caught up in the details of this passage, then we will lose what I believe the book of Revelation is trying to teach us. In fact, if you get caught up in the details of the New Jerusalem, then you're going to quickly think that the Bible seems to contradict itself. If you were to flip to the book of Ezekiel, which I won't have you do, you'll see the New Jerusalem is also talked about there, the same concept of New Jerusalem on earth and God bringing it in. And there it says that the New Jerusalem will not have any walls. And here we see a whole verse devoted to the size and the shape of the walls. Now you go, wait a minute. Chad's supposed to be the pastor. He's supposed to tell me that the Bible doesn't contradict itself, right? And I will now. When you read about the New Jerusalem in the Old Testament, it is in books that are written in a form of literature called poetic prophecy. And the goal of poetic prophecy is not to give you strict details. It's not a math book. It's not a science book. It's instead a book that says, look, I'm going to write a poem, and I'm going to tell you how great the future is going to be. And there might be some details that you can pull away from it, but the real thing that the author Ezekiel wanted you to get about the New Jerusalem, and I believe John in the book of Revelation, is not the details. And like, oh, it says a wall, and here's how thick the wall is. And it's really easy to do that in this passage because there's some numbers, right? But if we do that, then we have to go, wait, is there walls or is there no walls? And instead, we should say, oh, he's writing poetic prophecy in the Old Testament. And here, John is writing something called apocalyptic literature. And neither of them are to be taken you're going to read well on a literal level. Now you go, wait a minute, there's parts of the Bible we don't take literally? Yes. Like, for example, when the person that wrote the Song of Solomon says that his lover's hair is like a bunch of goats, right? We don't go, that's sick. I mean, that girl was ugly. And I don't call people ugly, but if she has goats in her hair, that is not a good-looking person, right? And we don't think that because it's a poem, and we understand. We understand it in even English, in all modern languages, right? If I said to you, love is like a rose, you would not go, wow, love is a flower? I never knew that. I'm going to fall in it, and I'm just going to jump in to some flowers, and then I'll start writing songs about it, right? We know that if somebody were to say love is like a rose, then we'd say it's a beautiful thing that sometimes pricks us and leaves us with hurts and pains, right? We would grasp that. And so when you approach the Bible, you need to approach it like you approach any book, and you need to try to understand the intent. And in the book of Revelation, the details are not nearly as important as the point that John and God through John is trying to prove to you and I, trying to teach us. And so when we approach this passage, everybody wants to go, how big is that? I mean, how big is this city? Because it gives some numbers, right? And everybody wants to go, what is clear gold? That's weird, right? I mean, what does it mean to have something be pure gold? That's beyond our imagination. But John is not trying to give you details about the New Jerusalem. Instead, he is trying to teach you something that I think is more important, and that is that the New Jerusalem, the new earth that is promised to Christians, is going to be splendid beyond anything that we know. And here's how you see it. John is writing this book to a group of Christian churches, seven churches there in the first couple of chapters of the book, and he's writing this to them because he knows that they are being persecuted and they are going to be persecuted even more than they already are. Now, some of that persecution is going to come through Jewish leaders at the time, but a good portion of that, or should I say bad portion of that, is going to come through Roman leadership. And so the Romans are going to flip a switch at some point and go from being, we're okay with that Christianity thing as long as it doesn't get in the way of what we're doing, yada, 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 to saying, we need to get rid of these Christian people. It is most specifically seen in a man named Nero. If you haven't heard of Nero, he was an emperor in Rome about the time that John was writing this book of Revelation and seeing the visions that God showed to him. Nero began his reign as emperor of Rome, not hating Christians really, being very open to them and okay with them. But then at some point he flipped a switch. In history, the theory that the history gives us is that a fire was started in Rome and it burned tons and tons of the city. And so Nero needed a scapegoat. Many people believe that Nero was actually responsible for it one way or another. And so Nero needed a scapegoat. And so he looks at this little group of people called Christians, and he says, you are going to be my scapegoat. And something inside of the man's head, psychologically really, just switches off, and he begins to persecute Christians horribly. When we think about Christian persecution in our country, sometimes we're like way off. Let me just give you a couple of things that Nero was known, this is history telling us this, to do to Christians. One, he would take Christians and he would use them to light his gardens by lighting them on fire. He'd put them up on a post and he would just light them in order to make it so that he had enough light in his courtyard and gardens. This is going to make him even sound sicker if that didn't make him sound sick enough. He would actually dress up in the skin of animals with the claws on, and he would release Christians in his courtyard, and he would hunt them and kill them with the animal skin that he was wearing. The man was absolutely horrible to Christian people, and John, depending on who you talk to, is writing just before Nero is going to start doing this stuff, or in the midst of Nero doing this stuff. And so he's writing to them, and he is encouraging them with this single thought. If you read the book of Revelation and you don't try to figure out what's a helicopter and all that, then this is the message that comes forward. It's this: persecution is bad, but keep living for God and worshiping Him, because it's going to be worth it in the end. You know more than most people about the book of Revelation. Now, if somebody ever says, what's the book of Revelation about? It's so complicated. I say, well, it's about this. Persecution happens. Keep living for God and worshiping Him, because it's worth it in the end. And so when we look at Revelation 21 and the end of it, John is continuing that message. And now you can kind of see the importance of heaven for these people, right? I mean, if you're a Christian and somebody's coming up to you and saying, are you a Christian? And your choice is to say no and lie about it, or to say yes and be burned to light somebody's garden, it's a really difficult thing to say yes. But if you know the greatness of what's coming, then you're far more likely to hold strong to the faith that you profess. And so John is writing this book, and he describes this new heaven to them, specifically a new earth, specifically a single city in the new earth, and that is Jerusalem. The Jewish readers had been looking forward to a new Jerusalem forever and ever. You can go way back to the Old Testament, book of Isaiah, thousands of years before Jesus even lived, many thousands of years before we live, and he was talking about a new Jerusalem, when God would change that city and make it glorious and all the nations would envy it, right? And so here we see a continuing description of that same thing. And the way that John describes it intentionally sets it up with Rome. Now you see, when you look through the book of Revelation, you see John describe oftentimes Rome, the city, not the nation, but the city specifically. And he refers to it as Babylon. Now you know way more than most people about the book of Revelation. So when you read the book of Revelation and you see Babylon, it's code word for Rome. You see, John was on an island when he wrote this book. And he was a prisoner there because of his faith. And he needed to be able to get a message to these churches. And the problem was, if he starts writing a book about Rome, and he's saying all these bad things, like, as we'll see in a second, calling Rome a prostitute, then you're going to have a real difficult time going, hey, Roman official, I need you to pass this along. Because they're going to read it and they're going to throw it in the garbage, right? But he uses code language and he says, look, Babylon is like a prostitute. So that he can get this off of the island of Patmos to the churches that it's going to. And so in the whole book, we see many descriptions of Rome. And here, what John does in the New Jerusalem is he takes those descriptions and he says, look at how much better the New Jerusalem will be. Now, here's what's really cool about this that you need to understand about Rome. Rome was the city. I mean, it was greater than anything the world had ever known. They were driving, and still in some ways, drive the way that we do politics. And they were driving philosophy. They were inventing philosophy in some ways. And they were driving commerce and the way that that worked. And they were the ones who really set up a more modern road system. And their architecture was incredible. And you can still see some of those buildings standing today, such as the Colosseum. And we go, wow. And we're thousands of years later, right? And these people and this city was beyond anything the world had ever known before. And here's what John does. Let's just look at this. John says in verse 9 that the New Jerusalem will be like a bride. Now, if you were to look at Revelation 17, 1 through 3, it would say this. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits by many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. And if you read just one more sentence, I should have included it. It's Rome. And so here he says, pay attention to this, Rome is like a prostitute. The greatest city ever is like a prostitute. The New Jerusalem will be like a bride. You see the contrast that he's trying to present? Now, I have the privilege of officiating weddings, and I don't like doing it at all. So none of you young people get married and ask me. I really do. It's stressful, and you know if you mess it up, they'll never forgive you. And if you do it right, nobody will ever remember you. And that's not a very good feeling. Nobody ever goes, man, that officiant was so good today. Everybody looks at the bride. Someday I'm a tripper. I'm just kidding. No, but the coolest part about doing weddings, really the thing that I like, if I can move this over, is that I am literally the only person who stares directly at the bride when she walks down the aisle. And this is going to make me sound way more romantic than I am. But everybody else looks at her an angle, but I look directly into her eyes. And I tell you this about a bride on their wedding day, they're always beautiful. And they are way more beautiful than they ever were before and sometimes ever will be again. And I mean that as a compliment. And I look, literally, it's not you, Steve Brace, but right here, I look directly into their eyes. And it's really a magnificent thing. And one of the most glorious times, I was doing a wedding for a high school friend and her fiance, and it was raining like crazy. It's like the worst day we've had ever in Oregon, and we're under a tent. And she came down the aisle, and it was beautiful to see the contrast between her and the world. And here, when John says that the New Jerusalem is like a bride, I think he has that in mind. Maybe John did weddings. And he's looking and he's saying, wow, that is beauty right there. And he contrasted to Rome, which he said was like a prostitute. We also see in verse 10, when you compare it to 17, 1 through 3, that the New Jerusalem comes down out of God, but Rome is said to be in the wilderness. So John isn't being factual in that. Rome was a city, it wasn't in the wilderness. But the comparison is the important part. Rome, wilderness. This city will come directly from God. History tells us that Roman cities had, the big, cool Roman cities in the empire, had three gates on one side of the walls. Here, John says that the New Jerusalem will have three gates on every side of the wall. See that? He just says, oh yeah, the good cities here that you know, I mean, they have one wall with three, but four times that. I mean, picture four times that. We have a gate on every side of the New Jerusalem. In Revelation 17:4, it says, the woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls, talking about Rome. In Revelation 18:11 and 12, we read, the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, Rome, because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk and scarlet cloth, every sort of citron wood, and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble. And in 1816, we read, woe, woe to you, great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet and glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. So John is not oblivious to the fact that Rome is a magnificent city, right? But notice in the New Jerusalem, it will be decorated with not a couple different kinds of stones, every kind of stone. I'm sure the pearls were nice that adorned Rome, but John says that the gates will be made of a single pearl in the New Jerusalem. He says, yeah, your pearls are great. That's wonderful that you put some pearls on your building, but our gates in the New Jerusalem will be made of single stones. That's some huge oysters, right? It also says that it lists all these different kinds of jewels, right? Far more jewels than it listed for the people of Rome and the city of Rome. And then it says that gold will be on the streets. And he's saying, hey, what you have in Rome is your treasure. That's asphalt in the New Jerusalem. It's unimportant. And then he describes something, as I mentioned earlier, that we can't even envision. I have no idea what it looks like. But gold that is clear as crystal. John is trying to make clear here that Rome fails in comparison. And he throws in the measurements, and it's fun to talk about the measurements, I know, even though it's a detail that's probably unimportant to us. But you read it. The angel in 15:16, the angel who talked with me and had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and its walls. The city was laid out like a square as long as it was wide. He measured the city with a rod and found it to be 12,000 stadia in length and as wide and high as it was long. Well, I have a globe here, and I know where Portland is. And down here, we have San Francisco, and down here, we have Los Angeles. Los Angeles is about 1,300 miles away, and 12,000 stadia is about 1,300 miles. And so what he describes for the city and its size, basically, is if a wall went from here to L.A. and was just as wide and just as high as that. It's really interesting because our atmosphere, the ecosphere, I think it's technically called, the part, it actually just goes a little bit beyond the 1,300 miles. And so it does stay within our planet, technically, this wall, but it's almost out of it. And so what John is making clear, if you can't tell, is that this new city on this new earth is going to be far and away greater than anything that you can imagine. Now, what's so great about it, in my opinion, is that John takes a city, right? I mean, it's a city. We can imagine a city. I know cities. This is a city that we're in. Portland's a city. I've been to some great cities that are magnificent. And I can look at that and say, heaven is something like that, but multiplied beyond anything I can really imagine. Here's what I want you to do now. We're very interactive today. I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to picture the greatest place that you have ever been. I will be picturing Disneyland. So close your eyes and picture the greatest city, most magnificent city, maybe the most a specific spot in the most magnificent city that you've ever been. And I just want you to picture that. And what I want you to hear is that John is saying, no matter what you are envisioning in your head right now, most beautiful, glorious city that our earth can produce, no matter what you are picturing, the city that God is offering to Christians blows that city out of the water. That city doesn't compare at all. So open your eyes again, and here's what we need to hear this morning. This is the important part of this. Verse 27, nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And so here is what John says. This is what the book of Revelation teaches. It says, if you are not a Christian, if you have not given your life to Jesus, then you don't get to be part of this amazing, splendid, incredible, beyond what we can even come up with in our imagination city. A lot of pastors, they want to sugarcoat. They want to make people feel good. I want to treat people like adults. And so if you're here, you're listening online, and you have not accepted the gift of salvation that Jesus offers, that he gave his life for you so that you could come out from under the curse and look forward to this city, then I just need you to know that you will not be in this city someday, but the Bible promises instead eternal death, eternal curse, really, and far worse than the curse that we know here. I hate that so many people want to sugarcoat that, because it is what the Bible teaches us and is what I believe. And so if you are not a person who has come out from under the curse, if you're not a person who says, I believe that Jesus died and I'm going to give him my life and live for him, then you do not look forward to this city. I mean, John looks at the most magnificent thing and he says, this is going to be far beyond that. And I look around and there's so many people. Maybe you're one of them who's like, oh, I would love to travel here, here, here. Oh, that'd be magnificent. And John is saying, if you believe and accept the gift of salvation that Jesus offers, you get to go somewhere far beyond any of those places you wish you could travel. But if you don't, you'll never be there, and it will be cursed forever. The truth is, if you have not given your life to Jesus, then the best thing that you have to look forward to is right now. Is your life right now, with all the sin and all the hurt and all the pain and all the broken relationships. That is the greatest thing that you can look forward to. And so give your life to Christ, because it's the only way to come out from under the curse and someday enter this eternal city. Now, there's others of you here that have accepted that and you've come out from under the curse. And here is my encouragement. This is what I want from you. Jesus says not to store up for yourself treasure on earth, but instead store up for yourself treasure in heaven. Sometimes that's a difficult thing to want to do, because I live here, right? I mean, I'm here, and I need to buy things, and I have a life to live, and all of that. But when you look at the gloriousness of heaven, don't you want what your life has been about to be stored up there so you can spend it later and not now in these imperfect, incomplete, non-comparable cities that we know? Let me explain it to you this way. When I was a little kid, I don't remember, I think I was about 9 years old, somehow I got $80 for one of my, I think it was Christmas or my birthday. And that's a lot of money. It might as well have been $1 million to me, right? And that summer, we were going to Disneyland. And so nobody told me that I couldn't spend my money. I had 80, I think it was 83. It's funny that I remember that. I didn't want to tell you. It's embarrassing. But it was $83. I'm pretty sure of it. I had $83 to spend. And I knew I could spend it on anything that I wanted to. And I knew we were going to Disneyland. So you know what I did? I held on to that money all summer long, because I wanted to buy something in Disneyland. And here's what I knew. I knew that anything that I got in Disneyland was going to be better than anything that I could buy in Salem. And so I saved that money all summer. I still have the thing that I bought. It's funny, it was a baseball thing, and I still have it in our house right now. And what I think Jesus says to us is that we can live our lives for the glory of this earth. We can do everything for now. We can spend our money for now. We can spend our time for now. We can use our gifts and our abilities to improve our lives now. We can work to have a better house and more popularity and all of that stuff now. Or we can choose to live a life where all of that stuff is stored for us in a place far beyond anything that we know. We can either spend our lives for this earth, or we can recognize that someday, if we're Christians, Jesus is going to come back and he's going to take us to something even better than Disneyland, and we can spend our lives on that. And so my encouragement for you, just in John's main point, and his main point is this: the most glorious thing you can imagine, multiply it by a whole bunch, and that is a picture of heaven. My encouragement for you is to say, I'm going to spend my life storing up treasure for the greater city, the greater place, the best place, something that's greater than anything that I can imagine. And so here's what I want from you this week. It's pretty simple. Now, I hope it's a whole lifestyle thing, but I just want one thing from you this week, and I guess I'll be satisfied until next week. What I want you to do is this week, I want you to make at least one decision to store up for yourself treasure in the New Jerusalem, a place that's far greater than anything you know. And so here's what it might be. It might be going to the store. It could be this simple and saying, there's a candy bar. I'm not going to buy the candy bar and be satisfied now, but I'm going to go give that dollar away to somebody that will be blessed by it. I'm going to drop it in the offering basket, whatever it might be. Here's another one, a simple one, right? You may just be sitting at home and you can turn on your TV, right? And you can spend time watching TV, and you'll be satisfied now, right? But here's what I ask you to do. I ask you instead to take a couple of our connection cards and just write on them and write an encouraging note to somebody in our church, because I think that will be storing up treasure in heaven someday. Here's another one that you could do. You could take some of your time and you could go fix our signs on our church property for me. And I think that you will be using that time not to satisfy yourself, but to store up treasure in heaven. There's a million different decisions that you can make just like that. I mean, it might be just getting up on the bus and giving somebody your seat so that you can begin a conversation with them and hopefully tell them about Jesus, whatever it might be. But this is what I'm asking for you. Hopefully it's your whole life, but at least one time this week, I want you to say, look, I'm going to lessen my satisfaction here, right now, in this moment, on this earth, this week, so that I can gain some satisfaction someday when Jesus returns and sets up a city and an earth that is like ours, because it's a city and an earth, but is far beyond anything that we can imagine, because it's so great and so glorious and so perfect. Will you guys do that? Raise your hand if you'll agree to do that. All right, so let me take a picture. Will you pray with me? Lord, I thank you that we have so much to look forward to, God, in your New Jerusalem, Lord. And it's interesting to me, God, because I myself, a lot of times I just strive and I fight to live more fully for you. But I forget that you, God, aren't just saying to do those things, to give things up and make decisions so that our lives are less happy, God, but so that everything is greater for us when we get into your kingdom. And Lord, it's hard. You know us, Lord, and you know the way we think. And it is difficult for us, God, to say, even I'm going to give up this candy bar so that I can have a dollar in heaven someday. That's difficult for us, Lord. But I pray in our hearts we would become people who are just eternally focused, Lord. Not because you're like forcing us to, God, but because you just paint this picture of your New Jerusalem that is beyond anything that we can imagine, but yet we have a little bit of imagination, and we know, God, that it's so much better than that even. And so I just pray for our people here at Creekside and those that will listen to this sermon later, and I just ask, God, that we would become more eternally focused, Lord. And I ask, God, that each of us, everybody that sits here that just agreed to make a decision to store up eternal treasure, God, would hold to that, Lord. And this week we would sacrifice some form of happiness or satisfaction on this planet so that someday when this planet is restored, God, we will have it then, Lord. We will move ourselves forward in your kingdom. I just pray that you would encourage us with that and you remind us of that, Lord. And God, I would ask that you would use that, Lord, in our people so that they can have conversations with people about you and tell them about why they have decided to make that decision, God, whatever it is. Jesus, we love you and we thank you for dying for our sins so that we could come out from under the curse and we can look forward to your eternal kingdom set up here when you mesh heaven and earth together, God, and we live in perfect splendor. Pray these things in your name. Amen.